Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, Why Wait for Heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is May 20th, 2016, and on today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. Now, today we're going to discuss an article that was written by the acclaimed ACIM teacher Ken Wapnick, and it's entitled The World as the Royal Road to Heaven. And I think that I can get you a link to this. So hopefully by the end of the show, I can put a link to this into the chat room. I think that you can find it actually on the Foundation for A Course in Miracles website. I'm not sure that's true, but I need to kind of go back through and figure out where I got it, and then maybe I can link you to it. And speaking of that chat room, you can join us there if you'd like to, and you can post comments or questions or that kind of thing. You know, just talk to us during the show. And the way that you get that, or get there rather, it is a private group on Facebook. And if you haven't been there before, you can go to the 12radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, you click the chat button, and you'll be automatically redirected to the private group, and you can ask to join. And our producer, Scott Weaver, will be there and will let you in. So if you'd like to join us there, please do. That. And there again, like I said, you can post questions or comments. And I assure you that even though I don't address them during the show, usually I do read all of those comments. So thank you for that. So welcome to Bruce Rawls. I'm so glad to be speaking with you again today, Bruce.
Hi, CA and everyone. Thanks for having me on your show again.
Yeah. And thanks once again for this suggestion for this particular article. I think this comes from The Lighthouse. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
And
yeah,
it is on their website.
It is. It is. And I'll when you send the link to the audio, I'll post that on ACI blog as well. And just as a quick aside, these Lighthouse articles are all superb. There was about a decade or so of these that Ken put out on a quarterly basis. And they're just brilliant. And they've actually, the folks in Temecula at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles have compiled these into a book, which also has some supplementary material that isn't on the website. I'm in the Will Rogers School of FACIM materials, so I haven't haven't met an offering from their store I didn't like, and you know, as well as all the stuff on their website. The FAQs are just brilliant. The Lighthouse, the articles, the YouTube videos, just there's so much on that website that's wonderful. And then also the Foundation for Inner Peace website, acim.org, the sister organization, has a wealth and, you know, depth and breadth of helpful information as well. So those two sites are sort of the gold standards to for course students to refer to.
Okay. Yeah. And I noticed this one is called actually Volume 7, Number 2, June 1996. Uh-huh. So if somebody goes to the website, which is www.facim.org, and you're looking for this, if you want to read along with us, it's Volume 7, Number 2, June 1996, and it's The World as the Royal Road to Heaven. Now, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, Bruce, I do have that collection that they put out. Uh-huh. Does that include all of the Lighthouse articles? I thought those were just selections.
Maybe. I believe it's every single Lighthouse article.
Oh my gosh, I didn't realize it was all of them. And
I haven't got a copy yet, but it's on my list to get.
Oh, well, it is just so incredible. And I have it, but what I like about it too is that it's written, or they've compiled it into categories. Uh-huh. So I tend to, like, I'll take a topic and read all of the ones on the topic.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know yet if maybe I can just search and go, okay, Volume 7, Number 2, you know. I probably could find that, or maybe it's in the index. I just found it right on their website with the link that you had given me.
Yeah, and then if you want to find a specific article, if you know the title, you can just Google that and then put FACIM, and you'll usually find it. I think they've changed the navigation a bit because they're wanting to encourage sales of the book, which is understandable, and we encourage that.
Uh-huh.
But you still can find a lot of those articles that way.
And, yeah. And I do love the book. And like I said, I like it for the reason that it's compiled in categories. And so I can just kind of choose a topic, you know, look at the index and just choose a topic and go, oh, I'm going to read these. They're so good. And for whatever reason, I guess I know what the reason is. I never read the Lighthouse articles. I just wasn't hooked into that, you know, when that was being published. And so I've not read any of those.
Oh, okay.
You know, not until recently.
Uh-huh.
And they're just wonderful little gems, just like the one we're going to talk about this morning.
They are indeed.
Yeah. And thank you so much for this. Before, you know, we came on the air today, I was telling Bruce that, oh man, did I need this one today. You know, there's just so much going on. And sometimes you just, in fact, I told him, I think it's kind of funny because in the article, it says that people that are Course in Miracles students are so inclined to be what Ken has called bliss ninnies, meaning that they just want to see everything as positive. In fact, in this article, he calls it positive spirituality. And I thought, boy, I don't fit that bill. I'm just kind of going around today going, life sucks, you know? And so when I thought, boy, I just really, really need to read this because as, you know, the world as the royal road to heaven, and it's a fairly complex article, but, you know, and somewhat based on some of the Freudian theory that it's all about projection. And so the only way we're ever going to remember that we have a mind is if we start looking at the things that we project. And there again, I was so anxious to read this, but thinking, I don't want to look at my world. I don't want to look at this stuff. Can't I be a bliss ninny? Can't I somehow think that this is not a reflection of my inner world? Mm-hmm. You know, I just didn't want to look at it. But I will admit, going through it and just being reminded, this particular one is just chock full of all kinds of references back to the text, to the manual for teachers, to the workbook for students. And, you know, I just felt so much better after I read it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just felt a whole lot better.
Well, I think it's because, you know, looking at the mind, really, I think intuitively, we all on some level realize that is our only way out. That's our only way out of the quagmire that this alleged, you know, this seemingly separate self. I like the SSS alliteration that we call ego concocted is. You know, the only way out of that crazy thought system is by looking at the contents of the mind and seeing what's in there and seeing that we don't want it. And one of the audios that you and I have talked about previously is lesson 182, where Ken describes, you know, how it's the idea is not for us to suffer, but it's to see how much we're already suffering and then choose against that. So I think what you described about your recent, you know, experience with looking at the world and seeing it as less than stellar.
An ideal, yeah.
You used a different adjective, but it's, you know, it's just, it's obviously, it is kind of sucky because it's, and the Course doesn't, you know, mince any words in describing, you know, he calls the body a rotting corpse in the Course. The author of the Course, not Ken, but anyway, but so we need to look at the investment we've had in this, you know, rotting, you know, morose and really depressing strategy that we've made that's dysfunctional and is maladaptive and but the best part of it is when we look at it, we see that it doesn't have to be our identity. It doesn't have to be our experience, but only if we look at it. And that's where the royal road comes in. And Ken talks about, you know, Freud's pivotal work and introducing the Western world, at least to this idea of projection and the unconscious mind and how dreams symbolically are, you know, a metaphor for, as we think of metaphors anyway, of what's in our unconscious mind. And so Freud's whole work was about, and as it states here in the second paragraph, you know, Sigmund Freud wrote, the interpretation of dreams is the royal road to a knowledge of the unconscious activities of the mind. Well, he was referring to the nighttime dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his, as Ken puts it, epochal interpretive dreams book. But that really can be extrapolated to include the daytime dreams, you know, because the Course says all your time is spent in dreaming. And we tend to forget that unless we have those little lucid moments and reminders. But the beauty of it is our script is not going to let us you know, slack off. Ultimately, you know, we may have moments of respite, but we are all on target. We can't flunk this course because we're going to get exactly the feedback we need continuously and mathematically perfectly, because our unconscious minds are projected out into this world. I mean, lesson 136 talks about you know, the double shield of oblivion. So the outer shield being the world is the reflection of that script. That's the outer reflection of an insane choice, and the inner shield, which is thinking that we destroyed perfect oneness somehow. We threw God under the bus. We whatever metaphor you like, you know, we somehow messed up that peace that's unassailable in truth. And because we actually believe that, we have the audacity to believe that, and we got so invested in it, and we forgot that there was an option, a real alternative, as of course puts it. We went to such great lengths as to make up an entire universe, and so that whole universe then is a reflection of that wish to be separate. And Ken, you know, gets into that at very, very in great depth in this article. Do you want to read some of this?
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, but there were just so many things going through my mind. Like, I don't think he actually says this in the article, but just that phrase from one of the workbook lessons, I'm not the victim of the world I see.
Mm-hmm.
I am not the victim. And that in the end is what always just gives us that sigh of relief of,
yeah,
oh my gosh, that's right. This is a dream. I did concoct this. Right. I mean, that's the saving grace.
It is.
That when we can remember that we do have a mind, because see, that's how I was kind of feeling. I'm a victim of the world I see. And it's like, you know, if you can just kind of get back to that point, you know, and just keep reminding yourself of that, come back to that teacher who says, no, you know, you can look at this, but by even looking at it, you can see how insane it is,
mm-hmm,
you know?
And the very identity of the one that looks is not the one that is identified with the victim script.
Right.
And we all have the victim script, but we all have the decision-making faculty that says, wait a minute, I can look at this script from an objective standpoint, see that I'm actually a mind that's choosing to either identify with that or not identify with it. And when we let go of that identification, suddenly it's like, oh, I'm peaceful. How'd that happen?
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily, you know, require anything more than just that recognition and release that says, I'm not happy. I don't enjoy being a victim, and being willing to be honest about that we have wanted to be a victim and have enjoyed it. But now, you know, our tolerance for pain may be high, but it's not infinite, as the Course says.
Yes.
Paraphrase, right? But so eventually we say, yeah, gosh, you know, I'm really not enjoying this whole victim thing. And then we can, you know, reveal to ourselves that's not working, and then release our white-knuckled grip on that identity. And then automatically it's replaced with an awareness that says, nothing happened here. This is a dream. This is a daytime dream that I concocted to scare myself, but I can take the same information and use it as a classroom instead of a prison. And that's where the Royal Road comes in, is looking at the mind, seeing that we have a choice in interpretation, and we can drop the victim script ego interpretation and say, you know, I actually made this up. And it doesn't affect the eternal being that I really am. And from that vantage point, I can afford to be peaceful about this. Even if things seem to be calamitous, you know, not only from afar, but, you know, right in our midst, you know, there could be things going on that we don't care for. But if we can look at the mind's reaction to it and become an observer, and forgive ourselves for the choice, that's where the unconscious you know, projections become conscious. And that's what toward the end of that second paragraph says, thus through analyzing or interpreting the symbols of our dreams, we would gain access to the unconscious, thereby fulfilling the goal of psychoanalysis of making the unconscious conscious. and then it then can continues. Only in this way, Freud believed, could people's neuroses caused by unconscious and therefore unresolved conflicts be healed. And so we need the world. We need that outer shield of oblivion in order to get back to the mind, because we might just, you know, as another Ken Fraser was, bliss ninnies, we might just go along and think, oh, everything is fine. And, you know, which is, you know, the sort of a triple shield, as Ken puts it, you know, if we deny the discomfort, then we're really, you know, making it a rough road. We'll get out of it eventually, but if we can just be honest about the discomfort and look at it and say, gee, this isn't making me happy, and then realize that it's a projection, I think that's hugely helpful, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and I love what Ken says a few paragraphs later when he calls it the cosmic plot against the truth. Boy, that sounds like the name of a novel, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Conspiracy theory. The cosmic right. plot against the truth.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the cover up is those shields of oblivion. I mean, that's the conspiracy, you know, is really, and you know, the old secret matrix that you know isn't just a movie. It's the big movie of our lives is all part of this incredibly sophisticated propaganda machine that is designed to keep us mindless and mesmerized and forever firefighting and chasing after, you know, the attainment of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And usually it all revolves around the body, or at least the personality, you know, in some fashion, or some way of stroking the ego or its puppet body. And if we can look at our investment in those things and those outcomes being a certain way and begin to not quite take them so seriously,
right?
Then, you know, that usually goes along with the willingness to look at the metaphor of our lives and the symbolic nature of things that are happening, not to make big deals out of the specifics, but to use the specifics to get back to the generalizations in the mind. And all it's really simple. All we have to do is, am I at peace? Am I feeling any kind of inward discomfort? And that's really, I think, you know, the key to getting on that royal road is just looking at the contents of, like you were talking about earlier, CA, the stuff going on in your life this past week or month. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, if I'm not at total peace, that means I've got a rich classroom to work with, and to see that the contents of my mind has been put out on a silver platter for me to do my forgiveness classroom work.
Right. Well, and you know, just that idea too that I had mentioned to you that I thought is worth, you know, putting out there for people. Because I know, like with this article, I do think it can be kind of complex, even though I really encourage people to read this, because this mm-hmm. is one of those times that Ken, he takes it from the beginning. He just lays it out kind of thing by thing by thing, you know, in terms of this is how it happened. This is the separation. This is kind of how we came to believe that we are a separate entity, that we could run away from God, that we could run away, and what we can do about that. And he does such a beautiful job always of just bringing it always back to the basics. But even if you can't go there, even if you, you know, you kind of get into this and go, okay, all this running away from God and separation, and even if you can't get at it from a spiritual perspective, you can read this article or you can listen to this information and think, but if you self-identify as a victim,
right?
So even if you can't go to the spirituality, if you believe that you're a victim, or if you believe that, you know, if that's your perception, that the second, you know, shoe is always going to drop, we really do have experiences based on who we believe we are. We attract those kinds of things simply because that's all that we see. I mean, it's almost as if there could be a rainbow of colors, but if we are limited to only seeing blue, we only see blue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why, too, I think, like I said, if you kind of feel like the rubber band of your mind is being stretched and stretched and stretched, and you can't quite go there, try to go with at least a little of it. You know, just try to push yourself in a slightly different direction and say, well, what if this is true? Uh-huh. What if, you know, my perception is really making the experiences of my life, or at least they're changing what I think I'm experiencing in life.
Exactly.
You know, I just think that is such an important thing, you know, so whether you're going with Freud or however you want to see it, you know, if I'm the victim of the world I see, if I believe that, then what is my life going to be like? What am I going to see? And of course, it comes right back to, and he says it in this article too, you know, help me see it a different way. You know, what teacher are you asking for? You know, what are you trying to see in your life? You know, what investment do we have in just perpetrating what is continuing to go on? Or do we kind of get to that point of saying, you know what? Yeah, I'm kind of tired of this. I do want to see something differently.
Yeah, and what you just said reminded me of one of Ken's comments that I think is really helpful. Is he says that you know, Jesus in the Course, the author of this beloved blue book, says, you know, in many different ways, he says, don't believe me, just try and see if it works. And he also says, you know, just he says that he appeals to, you know, our baser instincts. You know, he's not above that, doing that, because he says, you know, in a sort of a seemingly selfish way, but it ultimately is to get us to realize that our real self is the one that is where the peace is, the all-inclusive self. But because our identity is so wrapped up in, you know, the world, he says, if you just were willing to look at the qualitative difference in how you feel, and he says, you'll feel better. You know, if you stop condemning and making yourself the victim, if you look at those thoughts, you don't have to try to change them. You just have to be willing to look at them with the faculty of objectivity and clarity that we all have. And we may bury that and we may run from it. But there are times when, you know, we finally, in moments of defeat and recognizing that our judgments are not too great, and our assessments of things, you know, as the beginning of chapter 21 in the text says, you know, our cues for inference are wrong. You know, if we can remember that, you know, we might not have all the answers, and be willing to consider, you know, perhaps a more inclusive, expansive perspective, that, well, just maybe that victim script that we wrote and has our signature on the bottom of each page of the screenplay, you know, isn't cutting it for us, and be willing to look at the specifics as feedback, as a mechanism for getting us back to the mind, and using anything that comes up, whether it's, you know, an election year political speech, or something that ruffles our feathers, or something that someone that we live with does that, you know, we prefer be done a different way, or you know, traffic, or, you know, just pick any specific that may be either a minor irritation or annoyance to, you know, the out and out you know, battle, and see that is that royal road. That's that mechanism by which we get to see the contents of our unconscious mind and what we've projected in a way that we can then do something about it, because we can choose against the thought system that made that into a victim script.
Well, and that's the crux of it. In fact, he says in here, for it is the power of the Son of God to change his mind that is the ego's true enemy. Mm-hmm. And I love that, because once again, you know, we want to make it out that there are good guys and bad guys, or there's God and then there's the ego. There's this dichotomy. But the real enemy of the ego is the reminder that we can change our minds. And in fact, he says, he's quoting, I think, here from somewhere in the text, but he says, don't be afraid of the ego. It depends on your mind. And as you, the decision maker, made it by believing in it, so you can dispel it by withdrawing belief from it.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, we're decision makers. The power of changing your mind is everything.
It is, it is. And I think it's also helpful to remember that there are times when we're not going to want to do that. And even if we can just notice that we still want to be upset.
Yes.
And see and notice the mileage that we think we're getting out of it. Obviously, it's very dysfunctional mileage. but if we can see that, oh, I now have a story that I can, you know, lament about, and see if I can get sympathy for, you know, if we think that we're somehow getting mileage from it, just to watch that. even if it's something we don't share with anyone else, if it's just, you know, storing it up. One, another metaphor that Ken uses in one of his talks is, you know, that we have these bags of, you know, grab bags of, yeah. of things that you know, our guilt and woe stuff. I forget exactly how he calls it, but, you know, I think he used the word grab bag. And so, you know, whenever we, you know, start feeling too good, it's like, oh, well, just pull it. The ego strategy anyway is to pull into that grab bag and come up with some other issue. And so maybe we just, you know, stockpile our grievances so that when the topic comes up, we say, oh, yeah, I had that happen to me, too. And oh, yeah, I deserve pity. You know, maybe not in those words, but you know, because we think that somehow that's going to make us happier. And well, it never does, but
right.
but when we can look at that without condemning ourselves, I think, and but that observation is then what gets us back to making the unconscious conscious and gets our mind as the primary focus rather than a secondary thing again.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you said is so important. In fact, Ken mentions it in this article too. We have an investment in keeping it. We have, whether we want to admit that to ourselves or not, we have an investment in being the victim or in keeping the ego intact, you know, for whatever reason we do. And I was kind of chuckling or thinking back, there used to be a commercial, I haven't seen it for a long time, but the commercial was something about, you know, I there were two women roommates and one bathtub, and they both wanted to do, you know, the equivalent of Calgon, take me away. You know, they wanted to take a bath or whatever it was. And so one kind of comes in and drops her purse and says something about, my boyfriend broke up with me today. And the other one says, drop my coffee all over my desk. And they then battle back and forth with all the horrible things that have happened to them, to, you know, each trying to trump the other one. You know what I mean? And it's so funny, you know, lost my job. You know, mom says she's coming for a visit, whatever it is. It's sort of like they just keep going one after the other until finally one goes, okay, you win.
have you heard the Four Yorkshiremen?
No.
Oh, I'll have to send you the link. It's a classic Monty Python skit that ties into that perfectly. And it's basically four of the Monty Python troopers sitting around, you know, in their smoking jackets and lounge chairs, you know, obviously well off in their later life, and, you know, reminiscing about how bad they had it as kids. And I won't try to do it justice, but I'll send you the link and I'll post that on the when I, you know, post the audio and with their video, because it's just hilarious. But it's kind of how the ego thinks it's actually gaining ground by making, you know, a more pathetic victim story.
Right. You know. But we do it, you know, we absolutely do that. Yeah. And I mean, that's where when they keep saying how insane this belief system is, you have to believe it. I mean, how insane is that? I'm going to convince you I've got it worse than you've got it.
Yeah.
You know, how does that make either of us feel good? How does that make either of us win? You know?
Exactly. And the irony, of course, is that just the very fact that we've identified with something less than perfect oneness, that we identify with finite space-time characters that have a name and a social security number and a geography and a lifespan and, you know, a biology with quirks and issues and, you know, all that stuff. It's like, how incredibly limiting is that compared to what the voice that, you know, within us that wrote this material, you know, because we all wrote this. I mean, we all... because you know the course is a projection of our mind too, but it happens to be a more right-minded projection, like a lot of the mm-hmm. other non-dual metaphysical teachings that remind us that, you know, this is all part of a symbolic system. But we're walking symbols. We're actually, you know, the bodies that we think we are, and even the personalities, they're just symbols of an idea that somehow separation was possible. And so we don't recognize that until we make that conscious and recognize that, wow, I've got this whole thing backwards. I've turned the whole symbolic system inside out. We think that the mind, you know, is abstract and metaphorical and the world is real. And yet, the only thing that can be eternal is the mind. And what we think of as abstract is where the reality lies. And what we call space-time is actually a giant symbolic projection. it's a giant, massive, metaphoric movie that we have wholeheartedly, for the most part, adopted as our home. And we are so identified with our roles in that script that we've forgotten it's a movie.
Right.
You know, and we think we're dream figures instead of dreamers.
Absolutely. So. Well, and part of this too, something you kind of triggered in one of these paragraphs, he says, the purpose of all seeing is to show you what you wish to see. Mm-hmm. All hearing, but brings to your mind the sounds it wants to hear. You know, it kind of goes right back to that. If you have, you know, some kind of blinders on and you can only see the part of the spectrum that's blue, you're going to see blue. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. And you can deny there's red and greens and yellows, et cetera. But if you've got the blinders on that are only going to pick up blue, that's what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And, it, you know, you can keep projecting the red or projecting whatever those other colors are because you think they're not there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And you know, our power of denial is tremendous because we use that power to make up an entire cosmos. And like you say, the pragmatic aspect of this curriculum is that we don't have to really understand that whole, you know, profound psychological system and the ontological principles that Ken talks about. I had to look up ontological a few times before I even got a sense of what that word might mean. But the idea that, you know, all that, you know, theory is great, but it's a very practical course because if we're not at peace, we always have an option. We always can look at what's going on around us, see that royal road that is our life, see the dream world that we've made up that we call 3D reality, and bring it to the altar of the mind. Instead of letting the ego interpret it, that's always going to botch it. take it to the other altar, if you will, the one that's in the light instead of the dark, and there, our problems dissolve because we realize that they were unfounded. They were based on a lie, but it was a harmless lie. Ultimately, it was just a silly, forgivable belief that we, you know, somehow messed up perfection, and that we're able to shatter the innocence that we all share as one being.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of goes back to also, ultimately, it may be really, really miserable for us, but ultimately we did not change anything.
Right.
You know, yes. Nothing changed. It's once again, it's like watching a horror movie. Mm-hmm. The minute you turn the movie off, it's not real. It wasn't there. Even though we were having a really bad experience, it wasn't there. Mm-hmm. It didn't change, as they say somewhere, it didn't change one note in heaven.
Yeah. And I think that's where a lot of virtual reality films like Inception and The Matrix and things, movies like that, can be wonderful reminders that you know, we're in a movie. We can watch movies within a movie. Mm-hmm. And like you say, the first time I watched the movie Inception, which has all these different levels of dreaming in it,
right,
in the script, I had this little aha epiphany. As I walked out of the theater, I realized, okay, now I'm just back to one level of dreaming, or at least I think.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a cool aha moment because I realized, well, yeah, if this world, like the Course in Miracles suggests, is a dream, then now I can be more cognizant of my investment in it and see what that's getting me. And then, like you say, you know, the reality hasn't been changed that's behind that waits for us. And that's why the Course continues to go back and forth between the contrast between the desolation and the horrific, nightmarish, both strategy and outcome that the ego presents for us, and the total opposite that is really beyond opposites ultimately, because the awareness that we never left really is outside space and time, outside the world of duality. But we, you know, we don't really have much sense of that in normal waking consciousness. So the way we get back to it is through looking at the projection of our unconscious mind in the world. And one of the mechanisms for doing that is the principle of sameness. I think sameness is our gateway to oneness, because if we can see that we're all in the same boat, we all have the option to invest in ego's script and say, yeah, I'm a victim. and really identify with that. Or we can look at that and say, eh, not so much.
Right.
But we have that choice moment to moment to moment. And there's the practicality. We can choose, even in the most horrific, seemingly awful circumstances, we can choose against the ego's interpretation.
Yes. Once again, goes back to we can choose. Mm-hmm. We can choose. And, you know, I was thinking, I think I've told you this before, but it's a very vivid memory. When I was very young, we all went to the drive-in. You know, when there used to be drive-in movies? Mm-hmm. And my parents took us all to the drive-in. And quite frankly, a lot of us, the times, we'd just fall asleep. You know, and my parents would watch a movie, but they took us to see The Alamo. Okay. And I think it was that old version, maybe with John Wayne, and I don't know, it had a lot of stars. But anyway, you know, when the action got pretty rough, I just started crying my eyes out. And I'm sure I was ruining the movie for them. I cried and cried and cried, and I just couldn't stop crying. And I remember my mom, she just kept saying, "It's only a movie. It's only a movie." Uh-huh. But I just couldn't stop crying, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's probably the last time she took me to the drive-in, right? You know? But I remember that. And I mean, that comes to me often. It's only a movie. Because that's how she was trying to get me to stop crying, is this is not real. You know, you don't need to cry. This isn't real. But exactly. I couldn't separate myself from it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, such a great reminder. That's a good bumper sticker, or, you know, metaphoric message to you know, laser burn into our retinas. You know?
Right.
That's not that I'm recommending that, but you know, but that kind of a mnemonic to you know, get us, you know, jog our memory. And the course is not against us using those kind of artificial things, whether it's sticky notes everywhere reminders that we find helpful. You know, I use a lot of my acronyms, like, you know, guilt, individuality, space-time. If any of those things are involved, I know I'm, you know, back in ego's investment portfolio again.
Right.
Actually, that word investment to me kind of triggered a kind of an interesting metaphor a few moments ago. As you said, I was thinking, you know, recently they've had this expose on the Panama Papers, I think that's what they call it, Panama Papers, of all the different people who have had offshore investments and basically siphoned off government funds in different countries, things like that. And you know, basically, you know, the classic places think of are Swiss bank accounts and mm-hmm. Delaware and things like that. But apparently they're all over the world. Panama was one of the places where a lot of this was happening and a lot of this got exposed. But I was thinking, well, what a great metaphor for the egos trying to divert our attention like a magician, you know, saying, "Hey, look over here," while you know, the presto changeo is actually happening, you know, where we're not looking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the real investment is in the guilt. And that's what the ego doesn't want us to look at. And so the offshore investment, you know, is kind of like a bank account that isn't exposed to scrutiny or an investment that we don't have awareness of most of the time. And so this royal road is really a way of helping us, you know, anything that bugs us in the world, anything that we're not at peace about, whether it's a health situation, a financial situation, a relationship situation, whatever. Pick anything that's going on in your life that you're not at peace with. That's the royal road, and that's where you get to see where those ego's offshore investments are located, and look at the balance sheet and see, hey, there's nothing there.
Right.
There's a lot of time and energy invested there, but it's bankrupt. It's morally, ethically, and every other way bankrupt, because there's nothing there. It was founded on a lie, not a lie in the sense that. You know, we need to condemn ourselves for it, but a lie that was like nothing happened.
Right.
This is, like you say, it's a movie. It's a movie.
Well, and I like what you say when you say, what did you say? Something presto?
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
The magician diverting attention and, you know, where all the action is really happening is outside, you know, the range of vision of the audience. But that's kind of the ego's attempt at trickery to say, well, I'll just get your attention over here. But our mind knows that something's amiss. And if we just look at the contents of our mind with our inner kindness teacher, we get to see what's there. And I think the initial reaction is sometimes recoiling in horror. But once we practice it, we realize, hey, that's not so scary, because, you know, it may seem awful, but when we look at the desolation of the desert, it's like, well, there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. There, and we turn on the lights, and, you know, the boa constrictor, you know, that we thought was going to strangle us was just a garden hose, and you know, those kind of things, you know, the things that we thought were going to be really awful, when we look at it with our inner kindness teacher, with the Holy Spirit, as or the Jesus of the Course, whatever metaphor you like, the thought we took with us into the dream that says, I know the way out, here's the golden thread we can follow back out of the cavern of the mind, that awareness then shines the light on the scary monsters under the bed and sees that there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
A few little dust motes, and those are easily, you know, blown away with a puff of breath.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, whether you consider, I like that illusion, or I like that idea of the, you know, magic show, because mm-hmm. that's exactly what we do all the time. Look over here, don't look at the fact that maybe you have a mind. And yet, when we talk about the Holy Spirit, or when the Course talks about that, it really is that idea in the mind that we may look over there for a minute, but we always remember something is amiss. We mm-hmm. remember somehow that we're at a magic show. You know, and we can't quite get it because we're enjoying the fact that the tiger has disappeared off the stage or whatever it is. Uh-huh. But we know there's still that little voice within that says, okay, something is amiss. You know, this is not quite right. And the more we're willing to listen to that one little voice, you know, then we really can use this as the royal road. In fact, in this article, Ken says, were it not for our projections of the ego's thoughts of sin, guilt, and fear, we would have no opportunity to know of the existence of our minds, let alone the insane thoughts they contain. Mm-hmm. So once again, we can look at it, but, you know, they're part of the magic show. And if we look at them, then we can be reminded, you know, and almost listen to that little piece of cognitive dissonance is what I like to call it, where mm-hmm. it's like, we know these pieces don't fit together, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. I like that phrase a lot too, because I think it is, you know, even though it's a kind of highfalutin fancy phrase, if you think about cognitive just means mind, mental, mm-hmm. and dissonance just means something's clashing here. There's a conflict. And when we just kind of, you know, notice the idea that there's something amiss and if we're not at peace, you know, and that early workbook lesson, I could choose peace instead of this. If we just, you know, remember nothing but that, that we're choosing to think and feel whatever we're choosing, you know, whatever's going through our mind, then we, instead of being in the audience, we're Siegfried and Roy. We're the one
right.
doing the magic. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's right. I know this is a trick. And it's not that, you know, we don't necessarily have fun with the magic, but I think at some point we realize, gee, you know, maybe I could have even more fun in the real world rather than playing this sometimes scary and other times boring, you know, magical show to an
right.
audience, to an audience that is been terrorized far too long with that, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, what makes me think is, you know, juggling all those balls is so exhausting. Doing all those magic tricks ultimately is so exhausting.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And we'll tire of it.
Yes.
Here's a
phrase. I am tired of it. How can I stop?
You're already there. Wow, I'm impressed.
Yeah, I'm tired. At least I recognize I'm tired. There's got to be another way.
Really? Yeah. So you're in the Helen and Bill camp already, huh?
Yes, I am.
Good. Okay. Here's a sentence that I think really summarizes nicely what the mind is doing when, you know, we catch it, you know, and we watch it with that lucid sensibility. It is this joint dynamic of denial and projection, carrying out the need to have our guilt or self-hatred perceived outside of us, that collectively is the cause of the physical universe. On the individual level, these dynamics are reflected in the birth of the specific body, ours and others, to be the objects of our mind's denied and projected hatred, as explained to us in Lesson 161. And then it goes on to quote some of that workbook lessons. But it's basically saying that, you know, that we really are intrinsically peaceful, but we've made up a dream and believed in it so thoroughly that we thought we needed to both deny our complicit involvement in that dream and then project it out. So we wanted to get out of the mind, and then we wanted to make a further distraction, this massive magic show hologram, to keep us so mesmerized and enthralled that we would never, you know, look at the mind. I can't go there, because that's an even scarier place, you know. And yet, you know, when Toto pulls back the curtain, it's like, nah, it's not the thunder and the terrible Oz, you know, it's just this little guy who's pulling, you know, pulleys and throwing switches and moving levers and talking over a PA system, you know, and with a lot of special effects and fire, you know, it's just silly. It's just silly.
Yeah. Well, and I like this part where he says, I can't tell you exactly where it is, but he's giving us lots of examples of how we really do create the world. And it says, it is the witness to your state of mind, the outside picture of an inward condition. As a man thinketh, so does he perceive. Perception is a result and not a cause. And you will see the witness to the choice you made and learn from this to recognize which one you chose. And see, I always love that, because once again, you don't have to figure out, am I following the ego? Am I following my right mind? Look at what you're seeing, and it's going to tell you. But then this, I think, is comforting. He follows it up with, the world you see but shows you how much joy you have allowed yourself to see in you and to accept as yours. And it is this is its meaning, then the power to give it joy must lie within you. You know, yeah. Just kind of that affirmation. And I think it says that it comes from text chapter 21. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't think about that so much. But how much joy do we allow into our lives?
Exactly. And the beauty and the implication, I think, of this section, which is the preface to The Forgotten Song, which is one of my favorite passages in the whole book, is very inspiring and reminds us that joy really is our birthright. That introduction, the introductory paragraph, reminds us that the joy is not contingent on anything outside us.
Right.
And I think that is a hugely helpful idea that we fight at every turn. I think, you know, it's kind of like the ocean filling in to when you make a little depression in the water, mm-hmm. you know. We don't even think about it that, you know, if you push your hand down, there's going to be, and pull your hand out, there's going to be a hole in the ocean the shape of where your arm was. No, because the water's going to immediately fill that area. Well, that's kind of how the ego mind works, is, you know, it doesn't give a split second chance for us to you know, hold that thought that joy is really a choice at any given moment, that the thought system of peace and serenity and not being at the mercy of external circumstances, ego has no place for that. It immediately tries to fill that up with another part of the victim script. And so if we can be aware of that and see the resistance and then forgive ourselves for that resistance, then the next time that we are mindful, we can maybe make it last a little longer each time.
Right.
And realize that the joyousness that this is talking about couldn't possibly be contingent on any specifics. And we have access to it 24/7, 365.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's it. Joy and peace are the birthright. But we are withholding that from ourselves. It's like we're budgeting it out or something, you know? Like, so much.
A scarce resource, huh?
As a friend of mine likes to say, expand your tolerance for pleasure. Uh-huh. I always think that's such a funny phrase, but that's exactly it. We have to consciously expand our tolerance for being happy.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the happiness that the Course is talking about, again, is not contingent on any specifics. And we use the specifics as a way of limiting ourselves. And so that's where, again, that royal road comes in, is if we catch our mind saying, well, I'm going to be happy if or when, or, you know, fill in the blank with anything, mm-hmm. any specific thing, whether it's a person, a place, a substance, a thing, you know, a particular flavor of dessert to a, you know, color of car or, you know, life situation. I'll be happy if I'm not in dire poverty or suffering from some incurable disease, or, you know, it could be anything. The whole idea is that if we can begin to see that the power of the mind is so amazingly omnipotent, in not in terms of doing it ourselves as a separate self, but when we let go of the trying to do the John Wayne the archetype of trying to do it ourselves, you know, that we begin to see the real value of taking our inner kindness teacher's hand metaphorically and saying, I don't know how to interpret this, but if I give you the forum and the inner podium to share what's going on, maybe I will discover the peace that's there, that's independent of the circumstance that happens to be, you know, my experience in the world of dreams right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, one last thought, and I don't know if this is even pertinent, but I was just kind of thinking of, you know, when people have babies and they've got this little baby, I know sometimes what people will say is that a baby that wakes up needs to learn to put itself back to sleep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's that kind of back and forth, you know, do I give the baby a bottle? Do I, you know, go pick the baby up if it's crying or whatever? And just that idea that some kids truly, you notice it from the very beginning, some have to constantly be put back to sleep versus they just learn to put themselves back to sleep, you know, they play, you know, they just have this, their own little thing of waking up, seeing where they are, and they go back to sleep. And, you know, it just kind of reminds me that we kind of do the same thing is can we just learn to go for happiness, you know, or are we always going to look for happiness in some external thing, you know, mom and dad coming in and picking us up? Or can we recognize that happiness is a choice? Joy is a choice. It's always there. And it's not a matter of some external thing happening that can then give it to us. We learn that it's an inside job. You know, I mean, that's kind of where I'm going. It's just that, you know, that there's a big difference between thinking that things make you happy and then understanding how to make yourself happy.
Exactly.
You know,
and that you bring up a whole topic there that I think could easily take volumes or many hours.
Another hour.
the whole realm of wanting people other than ourselves, which of course we believe are other than ourselves, to behave in a certain way. And of course we wrote that into our ego's victim script in order to, you know, remind us that we do have a choice as to how we see each other person. And if we see all of spirit in each one we meet rather than someone who's making me unhappy.
Right.
big difference in that perception. That can be very liberating. And we always have that choice, even if we, you know, begrudgingly only admit that to ourselves once in a long while.
Yeah. Well, and along those same lines, and I'll make this quick because I realize we're getting to the end of our time, but, you know, it's the same thing with money. You know, it's sort of like it's not so much a matter of having money, but if I believe I can make money, if I believe I can attract money, then I'm not this victim of how much money somehow happens to come to me, because I've got the power to attract it. I've got the power to make it, you know, so whether that's happiness or money or the resources or feeling comfortable, feeling security, feeling loved, feeling whatever, there's this, it just feels to me like it is a little switch in our minds of remembering it is our minds. It's not, I'm not the victim of the world I see. I'm Bingo. Not the victim of the world I see, and somehow making that transition. So,
yeah.
Anyway, and if only we could. I'm going to flip that switch right now, Bruce.
Sounds good. I think I'll join you, and remember to you know, not beat myself up when I happen to notice this. The switch has somehow magically flipped back to the default ego position, and then realize that I can change the default over time. I can really change that to one of you know, kindness toward myself and seeing everyone as truly a brilliant actor that can bring me back to my mind and deserving of tremendous gratitude for showing me the contents of my unconscious mind. And so therefore I can.
That's right.
Be merciful instead of at the mercy of what's going on.
That's right. Well, do you have any quick comments or announcements that you'd like to make before we wrap up today?
Well, I'm still looking forward to being at the Weekend of Freedom Retreat in Estes Park, Colorado, the 16th through the 19th of June, which is a little less than a month away from now. And I also have fun sharing things like our recorded conversations and other conversations on ACIMblog.com. And always encourage people to check out the two main course websites, of course, which is ACIM.org and FACIM.org, the Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles, and both of them doing such wonderful work and have for decades to kind of share the heart and soul of the course with so many. And thank you for all the work that you're doing, CA, and then for all the listeners.
Oh, well, thank you. And Bruce, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it and look forward to another conversation.
Me too.
Okay. And everybody, I am going to post a few things in the chat room for you, including Bruce's site, which is acimblog.com, and that other one so that you can find the article that we're talking about today. So thanks for being here. Thanks for your comments in the chat room. You can always find me on 12listen.com. But I want to encourage you today to just stick around for the rest of the live shows that'll be produced by Scott Weaver. Thanks again, Scott Weaver, for being here today. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 12 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.